You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the author who said we need to be having more frank conversations about hormones and how they impact women and their mental health. Now, Governor Evers vetoed legislation last week that supporters say could have helped deal with the shortage of certified nursing assistants in Wisconsin. The bill would have lowered the number of training hours for CNAs from 120 to 75, which would put them in line with federal standards. But critics said the change wouldn't leave CNAs equipped to deal with the complex care they're expected to give. Last week, we heard from someone from UW-Madison's School of Nursing who opposed the bill. Today, we'll hear from a supporter. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work as a CNA or with CNAs? What do you think of the idea of reducing the number of mandated training hours? Again, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Gay Magnifici is a Republican member of the Wisconsin State Assembly representing the 28th Assembly District in northwestern Wisconsin. This includes most of Polk and Burnett counties, as well as some of St. Croix. She also previously worked as a registered nurse for 35 years. Representative Magnifici, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Judith. I'm happy to be here today.
Well, tell us what your reaction was to the governor's veto of this legislation.
I was extremely disappointed that Governor Evers vetoed this much-needed bill to help with the long-term crisis that we have here in northwest Wisconsin. My district is very rural. It borders Minnesota. And Minnesota abides by the federal CNA training hours, and they are ranked second highest for quality of care among all 50 states. And I have made it a point to visit several of the nursing homes in my area. I've talked to administrators, registered nurses, and the CNAs, and most were very supportive of this bill because it just seems that everyone is short of help and that they're having to work overtime, and it's really hard on them. And this bill did receive bipartisan support, and our Democrat senator here in the 10th District is also a co-sponsor of this bill.
So can you make the case for us, Representative, why would reducing the number of training hours for CNAs help deal with that shortage that your district and many others are dealing with?
Well, I know there's CNAs from Minnesota that would love to come over here and work, but they would be required to either repeat the 120 hours or take an additional 45 hours, even though they have years of experience. And I think it would just really help as far as like single moms that they could, get the training done and get to work.
Last week, we spoke to Sarah Endicott. She's with UW-Madison's School of Nursing, and she operates skilled nursing facilities in rural Wisconsin. She supported the veto of the bill, and here's a little of what she had to say.
People come into the field, they're interested in healthcare and helping others, but then they run into challenges once they're working in those settings and they leave. And not necessarily for higher paying jobs, but because they don't feel like they have, in some cases, the training and the education they need to provide the kind of care that they want to give.
So Sarah's saying there that people are leaving these jobs, which is making the shortage worse because they don't have all the training they need, not because there's too much training. What would you respond to that?
I don't think that they're leaving because they don't have enough training. I think they might be getting burnt out because the nursing homes are short of help and they're having to work harder to make up for that. So, and I know I've talked to some CNAs here in the Amory area, and they talked about how the new CNAs are teamed up with experienced CNAs so that they gain skills and competence.
Go ahead, please.
No, it's just that, I believe that this bill is just a small step to kind of ease the staffing shortage. But the CNAs are teamed up with experienced CNAs. They work as a team. They're just, I just believe that the CNAs are dedicated, caring, and compassionate, skilled caregivers. I mean, they are the eyes and the ears of the nursing staff, and they're a very important part of the healthcare team. But I believe training is ongoing. I know when I worked as a nurse, I learned something new every day. And every facility, I think, is just a little bit different. And these CNAs are just great. They adapt to changes. And I just don't see that that's an issue.
We're talking right now with Representative Gay Magnifici. She's a Republican member of the Wisconsin State Assembly, and she supported the bill that would have reduced the mandated number of hours for training of certified nursing assistants. And let's go to the phone, and Judy in Ripon is with us. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I've been an ICU nurse for over 30 years. My husband is a physician that took care of, he doesn't any longer, but took care of nursing home patients on a regular basis. Do not ratchet things down continuously. We are constantly ratcheting down education. That is not the answer to getting them to stay or even getting them into the field. The answer is more pay, which, of course, isn't going to happen. My husband would call, and he would want to talk to an RN on the floor at the nursing home. There was not a one to be found. They're so overworked and so busy, so he would have to talk to the CNAs. Now, back when I was in nursing school, we were taught that the CNAs do not speak with the physicians. They have to, it has to be an RN, licensed RN, to speak with a physician. So he would, and this is no longer the case. The laws haven't changed, but the actual practice has changed. So what happens is he's talking to CNAs, and they do not have a clue about what he's asking. They are, and it's not their fault. It's not their fault. They're trying hard. But reducing the amount of education for anybody caring for, you know, our elderly is not the answer. We don't decrease the amount of hours and training for a firefighter. My gosh, you know.
Thanks for that call, Judy. And Representative Magnifici, lots of issues there, one of which is the issue of pay. We did hear from a few callers last week who brought up the issue of pay for CNAs being so low. How big a factor do you think that issue is to keeping people in the field?
Oh, I think pay is a big factor. I know in this biannual budget that we just had, I know there was an increase of $67 million that was to improve wages for direct care staff. And then direct funding to nursing homes was supposed to be increased by $74 million. And then there was $91 million that was to increase for funding to help seniors and people with disabilities to stay in their homes. But, yeah, I totally agree with that, that funding and pay is a big factor. Because it is. It's hard work. It's physical work. It's emotionally draining work. And these CNAs are just, they are dedicated. They love what they do. My dad spent the last 8 months of his life, he was 93, he had a heart attack, and was in a nursing home for 8 months. I was there every day that I possibly could be there. And I worked with the CNAs too. They were just awesome. They're hardworking and dedicated. I couldn't have asked for better help.
It seems, Representative Magnifici, that there is a lot of agreement on either side of this issue, that CNAs work hard, that they deserve more pay, that it's hard work, mm-hmm. and that it's often the most vulnerable members of our families and our communities yeah. who are receiving care primarily from CNAs. Given that there is so much agreement around this issue, moving forward, are you planning to go back to the drawing board and work with Governor Evers and his administration to hopefully find some solutions that everyone can get on board with?
I am on the Committee for Aging and Long-Term Care, and I am committed to helping it any way that to help ease the staffing shortage and to increase pay for the CNAs. Just because in our district, up in the northwestern area of Wisconsin, we have an aging population, and it's only going to get worse. So I would rather do something now about it. I mean, we're in a crisis situation already, but it's only going to get worse, and I am willing to do whatever it takes to help. But I really think this bill would definitely have helped a little bit. It would have been a step.
Well, Representative Magnifici, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
That was Gay Magnifici, a Republican member of the Wisconsin State Assembly. She represents the 28th Assembly District that includes most of Polk and Burnett counties, as well as part of St. Croix. She was with us today to talk about why she supported legislation that would have reduced the state's training requirements for CNAs to be in line with federal standards. Governor Evers vetoed that legislation last week. You can find our interview with a UW-Madison School of Nursing professor who supported that move online at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, many of us might be enjoying some turkey on the Thanksgiving plate tomorrow. We find out why turkey is a great, affordable, and sustainable food. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, turkey. We eat a lot of it, about 210 million turkeys this year, in fact, and that's only in the U.S. But raising turkeys isn't the same as it used to be. We find out more from a food economist. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Jenny Peek answering a Wisconsin question about how county roads get their names.
If you've taken a drive on one of Wisconsin's iconic scenic roads, chances are you've noticed a bit of alphabet soup.
I'm Stephanie Elkins, and for many years lived on a retired dairy farm in Greene County that was near the intersection of J and C, and we had to take County H out of New Galeras to get there, and on the way to work, I would take County J to County G.
I'm Dean Collenbeck. I grew up on County Highway D in Barron County, 21-mile stretch of road that starts at the intersection with County P and ending at County Double S on the west side of Chautauqua.
My name is Jana Rose Schleiss. County Highway BB, two Bs, is near where I grew up. People call it Double B. I am one of those people. It actually splits Kewaunee and Manitowoc County.
And trying to tell people about this who are not from the area. Yeah, okay, so look for County J, and it's not the same J that's in the other county. It's a different J. And watch for County A, and there's a dog leg, and, you know, it can be very complicated.
So is there any rhyme or reason to how these highways got their names? Shelley from Marshall wanted to know. She asked, why are Wisconsin's county roads labeled with letters instead of numbers? So we reached out to Daniel Federley, executive director of the Wisconsin County Highway Association, to find out.
It's good to start off with a little background. We have state highways that are under state jurisdiction, and we have county highways that are under each of the individual counties, 72 counties in the state. The numbering and lettering came about out of some legislation that happened over 100 years ago now. That system was first set up in 1917, and the Wisconsin County Highway Association was initially formed in 1911. It is credited as being the oldest such association in the nation.
That makes sense, but what about those highway names?
To speak directly to your question, it was designated that it should be signed, marked, and maintained. Previous to that, roads in the nation were not ever really marked. They just happened to be wherever they were. But after the Highway Commission began looking at it, they adopted, for the first time ever in the nation, the system of numbered highways for the state and lettered highways for the county. You'll find virtually every county certain letters that are the, I guess, for lack of a better term, the more popular. I can't say every county has a County Trunk Highway B, for example, or a County Highway N, but you will find that the vast majority of the counties will have the same ones because we only have the 26 letters to work with. As you can imagine, over the last 100-plus years, as the county gained more roads and took over certain roads and things of that nature, they used up all the letters of the alphabet. And so subsequently, then, once they've used them up, they would go to the double, TT, double S, things of that nature. And then after that, they would start doing variations thereof, you know, county CE or something of that nature. That seems like a simple question, but as you can see, there's a great deal of history. I think certainly we at the Wisconsin County Highway Association are proud of that history because we've been a leader in the nation for forever.
I remember years ago, there's a place we used to go, just a couple miles.
That was Daniel Federle of the Wisconsin County Highway Association talking about the state's lettered highway names. And this story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question, and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Jenny Peek.
Now, many of us are spending time with friends and family tomorrow for the Thanksgiving holiday, and for some, this can mean spending quite a bit of money, often on food and drinks. But our next guest says we should be grateful for the affordable turkey. Jason Lusk is a food and agricultural economist who studies what we eat and why we eat it. He's also the department head and distinguished professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University. He wrote the piece, Time to Give Thanks for Affordable and Sustainable Turkey, for The Conversation. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, it's the rare consumer product that has not gotten more expensive in the last 40 years or so, but turkey might be the exception. It's actually gotten cheaper, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And it's not just turkey. It's really a lot of our foodstuffs, particularly the food that we buy in the grocery store, has, you know, remained very affordable over the last 10 or 20 years, hasn't experienced the same kind of inflation that we've seen for many of our other kinds of products.
Free range is a term that we've been seeing in food labeling and packaging for animal products. Turkey isn't raised that way. Should we be concerned about that?
Well, the first thing to note about turkeys is that all turkeys are raised cage-free. Most turkeys are raised in big open barns where they have lots of room to move around. Free range just means they have the ability to go outdoors. And, you know, there's some positive things associated with that. But when you look at the animal welfare studies, what we tend to find is that the ability to go outdoors ranks pretty low on the list of things that might be important in determining animal welfare. And you could imagine why. I suspect outside for many of your listeners today, it's cold and windy. So turkeys don't want to be out in that any more than we do. So farmers have a reason for bringing them indoors to protect them, not only from the weather, but from pests and from diseases.
And from predators, you say as well.
Well, that's right. And one of the challenges with keeping truly free-range, whether it's turkeys or chickens, is that there are, of course, dogs and coyotes, but hawks and other animals that want to eat them just like we do. And so that's one of the advantages also to bringing those animals indoors.
Often people are looking at different products, and one of the factors that they take into account is whether there are chemicals or things like artificial hormones or antibiotics used in products. What do we know about turkey raising and those particular issues?
Well, I think the first thing to note is all of our food products, including animal products, are very heavily regulated on these issues. And you know, you can't just willy-nilly use, you know, growth hormones or antibiotics on any products. With turkeys in particular, I think it's important to note that hormones are not allowed. So this is not an issue in terms of, you know, larger turkeys because of, you know, added hormone use, because that's just an unallowed product with regard to these birds. Producers can use antibiotics, but they do have to observe withdrawal times, and it's actually illegal to sell turkeys that have antibiotic residues. So while there might be some concerns about, you know, overall antibiotic resistance that might develop kind of at the farm level, you know, the risk to you as an individual consumer as a food safety risk is essentially nil, because it's frankly illegal to sell turkey that has antibiotic residues on it.
Now, you say in your article that part of the reason turkeys are more affordable is because farmers are needing less and less time and less feed to get them to market weight. Why is that happening?
Well, it's a really a combination of factors that have led to increased productivity. It's what I just talked about before, bringing animals indoors. While there are some trade-offs there that we talked about with regard to free range, it has the advantage of turkeys living a more comfortable life, allows them to grow a little faster. There have been improvements in genetics, so over the years, selecting birds that tend to grow a little faster, that tend to grow a little more on the same amount of feed, and a variety of other just management practices have allowed us to grow birds more quickly with less food, less land than we did in the past. And a bird today is probably on average about 10 pounds heavier than it was in the 1970s.
And you say that that's a win for sustainability. Why?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, first, it's a win for our pocketbooks. But I think these productivity stories are also really important in terms of sustainability. So I think the best way to illustrate this is through an example. So if we were stuck in 1970s technology, meaning the amount of, you know, the number of pounds per turkey, you know, we would ask how many more turkeys would we need today to satisfy our current demand if we were stuck in this older, lower productivity technology? And the answer is we would need about 130 million more turkeys to satisfy today's food consumers than we currently do with the new and improved technologies. So that's 130 million turkeys that we saved. And all those turkeys would have needed something to eat. They would have needed somewhere to stay. They would have emitted waste and contributed to carbon emissions. All those things we saved because somehow we figured out how to get more using less, that we, you know, and it's that whole combination of factors that I mentioned before: better housing, better genetics, better diets, and just better know-how and science and entrepreneurship.
Well, Jason, I can't let you go without asking, are you going to be having turkey tomorrow?
I will, but we're also going to have beef too. So we like to diversify our diet. So we're gonna have more than enough to eat tomorrow.
Well, I hope you have a great dinner, Jason. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jason Lusk is a food and agricultural economist who studies what we eat and why we eat it. He's also the department head and distinguished professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University. He joined us to talk about why turkey has become both an affordable and sustainable mealtime option in recent years. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new book who says we need to talk more and more openly about women and the intersection of hormones and mental health. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, and for Rob Ferret, you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests dig into the ongoing problems in the chocolate industry, which include child labor, slave labor, and environmental concerns. They'll also discuss how consumers can take into account those issues when they buy chocolate. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, getting your period is often a childhood moment that is seared into girls' and women's memories. And then it's common to be pretty obsessed with making sure that it doesn't cause you embarrassment, like bleeding through your clothes at school or out in public. Despite the amazing things that women's hormones make possible, think of getting pregnant, giving birth, nursing a baby, and more, being hormonal is often used to minimize women and their physical, mental, and emotional abilities. Journalist Eleanor Morgan is the author of the new book, Hysterical, Why We Need to Talk About Women, Hormones, and Mental Health. She's also training to be a psychologist. Eleanor, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, give us a brief description of what hormones actually do in the human body.
Well, it's a myth that only women have hormones. It is an essential group of chemical transmitters in men and women that do all kinds of things. So insulin is a hormone, and we know that insulin is related to our energy levels. Adrenaline, which, you know, we need to kind of do stuff. Cortisol, the stress hormone. There's plenty. And for women, there is a branch of our sex hormones, which are responsible for our reproductive processes. The main one you were mentioning in your intro, our menstrual cycle. So during our menstrual cycle, over the course of the month, if we go with a 30-day cycle, they will fluctuate in quite big spikes twice. So when we ovulate and just before we get our period. And then over the course of our life, in pregnancy, breastfeeding, any sort of reproductive condition like endometriosis or PCOS, polycystic ovaries, and then up to menopause. Fluctuating hormones and different levels of different things can have a really marked effect on our body and our mind.
You talk a lot in your book about the many cultural ideas and values that surround girls starting to menstruate. Can you share a few of those with us?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, as you were mentioning, it, you know, brilliantly, actually, I think it's the beginning of when we sort of sense the gaze changing. I think it's the kind of the tipping point of kind of nascent adulthood and, you know, starting to bleed, even though we are made aware of it. And certainly here in the UK, you know, we're made aware of it from primary school. So I don't know what that would be for you. But when we're about 8, 9, 10, you know, we're kind of educated on what's going to happen. But I think it's that beginning of sexual maturity that comes with, you know, it comes with all sorts of social conditioning. And I think it comes with a sense of shame. I think, you know, we're kind of rigged to be ashamed of what our bodies are doing right from the beginning. You know, I've certainly felt that. I know that many of my female friends have felt that. I do think it's changing. I think as the conversation around menstruation, you know, there's lots of books out about this now and female bodies and kind of reclaiming the meaning. But I don't think it really goes away. I think there is an element, you know, it's so inherently female. It's so connected to all of this conditioning about what it means to be a menstruating woman. And I think that all sort of shifts into gear when we start having our periods. You know, we become hyper aware of what our bodies are doing. It's a big shift for sure.
Well, and it's been portrayed in various ways in pop culture as well. I think anyone who's seen the horror movie Carrie has
yes.
seen one of the more, shall we call it, memorable depictions. What
yeah.
messages do we get from pop culture about women and their hormonal lives?
Gosh, I mean, Carrie is a brilliant example. And I actually talk about that in some detail in the book. I think that the scene, I mean, I'm talking on the assumption that people listening have watched it, you know, the levels and the layers of shame, you know, that she's feeling and that are kind of being thrust upon her by people around her and her teacher is just appalling. You know, the misogyny is just astonishing. But I think it's, you know, I think it's this thing that is, like I was saying before, it's so inherently female. And I think in pop culture, I think menstruation and hormones are often used, certainly in the past, I think are used as this tool to sort, you know, it is a kind of repressive tool and it's a way of pathologizing female, you know, women's behavior. You know, that old trope of, oh, she's on her period or she's about to get her period, as if it's this absolute gold standard, you know, explainer for how a woman is thinking or behaving. You know, she couldn't possibly be annoyed or angry with someone's behavior, you know, on the fact of it. There has to be some inherent, you know, biological reason that this woman is behaving strangely. And I think we've seen that, you know, Carrie, there are other horror films, but, you know, just in the kind of all of the teen films that I watched growing up, you know, I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but I feel like that trope is so well worn and I grew up with that. And I think, you know, the deep conditioning that creates is that you're constantly fighting against this idea that being quote unquote hormonal is, you know, you're sort of inherently less trustworthy or reliable, or your behavior is inherently sort of, you know, just it is the kind of the hysterical woman mm-hmm. trope in a different form.
And it's not that long ago that I remember a fairly serious discussion of whether a woman could or should be president. And one of the things was Yeah, but if, you know, if she's hormonal and she's got, you know, basically the button for the nuclear bomb, we're all in big trouble.
God, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's just astonishing. I think actually more than anything, and on that note, I think it's a really good example to think about this. There's a whole world of psychology that, you know, critical psychology, and there's a lot of women in that category who kind of really sort of challenge the orthodoxy of, you know, past psychology, psychiatry. And there is this idea that when we are quote unquote hormonal, so premenstrual, for example, which is when we're sort of supposed to be erratic, irrational, very emotional, that actually it's sort of our hormones are a kind of truth serum. And it's actually when we have the most clarity about what is right or wrong, or, you know, morally just. And actually, I think given that we know so little precision about, you know, the exact effects of our rising and falling sex hormones, you know, there really isn't a definitive line in science. And believe me, I've looked at the literature in depth that says, you know, a level of this hormone, progesterone, for example, inherently will make a woman, you know, more irrational or more flighty. You know, there's suggestions, but like any brain and body interaction, it's, you know, it's very difficult to be precise. So on that basis, I think I would trust a woman more than anyone to kind of have, you know, the moral compass. Yeah, but it's fascinating, you know, just you saying that is kind of course that's something that people think.
We're talking with Eleanor Morgan right now. She's the author of the new book, Hysterical, Why We Need to Talk About Women, Hormones, and Mental Health. And Eleanor, we were talking earlier that things have gotten better in a lot of ways in how girls and women view very natural processes that their bodies go through, like menstruating. Why does it matter if women aren't sharing with each other or with the males in their lives? Because I think that is still something that that we're falling down on.
I think there's lots of possible answers to that question. And I do think there is this ingrained sense of, I think we've been fighting for so long to kind of rid ourselves of this, you know, chocolate hogging, howling at the moon, you know, hormonal hysterical stereotype, that I think maybe there is a sense of you don't want to be seen as that. And you spend a lot of time fighting against it to, you know, be kind of steady, you know, the kind of nurturing woman that we quote unquote should be in society. But it's fascinating, you know, when I've had conversations since the book came out, that's been one of the most common questions. And I think there is also a kind of deep shame, and I keep using the word shame because I think it's incredibly relevant to the kind of animal femaleness of all of this stuff, you know, blood, you know, our bodies being sort of leaky in a non-sexual way. You know, I think from when we're very young, we make so much effort to keep this stuff concealed. And I think that doesn't really go away. You know, I think it probably does to an extent. And I think now, to use a word that I don't particularly like, but I think teen girls, young women are much more woke to their, you know, to their bodies and what their bodies are doing. And I think have a lot less expectation that they should fall in line with what men expect their bodies to do, or how they should, you know, how they should be in the world. But I do think there is tension, certainly, I think, in heterosexual relationships where, you know, there's two very, very different bodies in that, you know, in that setup. One body that's doing something very, very different to the other. and has this, you know, this inbuilt rhythm and fluctuations in hormones that the other just doesn't have. So I think there's always a tension there, but I think it comes down to, you know, the ability to be compassionate and empathic. You know, if you really want to understand your partner, you will. But I think there's so much interesting stuff that comes up in those conversations. I've heard some very interesting things about male partner responses to certain things. But I also know, you know, my heterosexual female friends and their male partners that are incredibly understanding and, you know, really want to understand, don't want to sort of make assumptions. It's a good question.
We're talking with Eleanor Morgan right now. She's the author of the new book, Hysterical, Why We Need to Talk About Women, Hormones, and Mental Health. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Why do you think the natural hormonal realities of being a woman are so taboo to talk about? What do you wish your mother, sisters, aunts, or friends had shared with you? Do you talk freely with other women about your experiences? And if not, what holds you back? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we continue our conversation with Eleanor Morgan. She's the author of the new book, Hysterical, Why We Need to Talk About Women, Hormones, and Mental Health. And Eleanor, I'd like now to turn to menopause. And as a woman in my early 50s, I have been astonished by what I didn't know, what I didn't know to expect, and how we are really not prepared for what we might experience. What goes on in a woman's body when we hit that stage of life?
Gosh, I mean, there's no real kind of cookie cutter set of symptoms, or I mean, there are. There's a kind of a big list of things that we know happen to lots of women, but you know, no one woman's physiology is identical to another. So although we know, and you know, I've become very familiar with the literature in this area, you know, the classic symptoms like hot flushes, sweating, you know, anxiety, low mood, low libido, dryness, all sorts of really rough things, you know, and I have friends that are going through this now. I think it's very hard to be completely prescriptive about it. But what I do know is that the perimenopause stage, which can begin, I mean, I have a friend who's in her late 30s who is perimenopausal. And I think that can go on for quite a while.
Years.
And for some women, yes, years. But I think for some women, it can also be very quick. If I think about my mum, my mother, I think the whole process was a couple of years, you know, which is fantastic. She had terrible periods her whole adult life. And I hope that my trajectory is something like that. But it's a really, you know, on a kind of hormonal, you know, on a bodily level, it's a really fascinating, but, you know, very difficult, profoundly difficult time in a woman's life. But it's, you know, our hormones are, to use a terribly scientific phrase, completely all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's not just biological. It can be very emotional as well. And I find myself wondering how much of that is hormonal and how much of that can be cultural as well.
Yeah, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. I think it's no experience involving our sex hormones, you know, which are responsible for menstruation, all the rest of it. The way we feel is never just biological. And I think that's the key thing that became so apparent when I was researching this book and in my psychological training. You know, biology is never, ever, ever the full picture. You know, so many different environmental factors, all of the social conditioning we have throughout our lives about how a woman should behave emotionally, you know, keeping our emotions in check, how we should be with the people we love, with the people around us, at work. And I think when things are sort of chemically chaotic, I think we lose resilience. You know, that tends to be the explanation that makes the most sense. But I think no one could ever give you a precise answer. There are a hell of a lot of things going on, but, you know, the emotional distress of, you know, of that time it's both biological, environmental, sociological, you know, it's based on so many things. And I think the key takeaway, and certainly from a clinical perspective, is how you can most self-compassionately manage your symptoms. And for some women, that will be taking HRT, and it will be like a miracle. And I've seen that, you know, I've seen that firsthand. For some women, it will be HRT and doing some really good talking therapy. Some women don't need to use HRT. You know, there isn't really, you know, there isn't really a one size fits all approach, but there are lots of options. But I think self-compassion is, God, it's just the thing that runs through all of it. If you're struggling to exercise self-compassion, I think, and you're constantly fighting against how you feel emotionally, you know, we know that that's a massive exacerbator for anxiety, depression, you know, those are clinical terms, but just general feelings of being able to cope with the people around you with difficult stuff. I mean, I'm very, because I'm training as a psychologist, I'm very pro talking therapy. But I think it can really, you know, you really start to dig into why it's so difficult to be less resilient, why it's so difficult to sort of find that you can't give as much in your relationships with your family, you know, with your kids, with your colleagues.
And Eleanor, I want to jump on to bring a caller on in our last couple of minutes here. Kelly in Cascade, Wisconsin is up. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a great topic. So my daughters are kind of in the tween years, and I'm perimenopausal. And so it's an interesting mix. And my husband grew up as one of four boys, so has really a hard time understanding us. And I grew up with all girls, so the female way of talking and relating makes a lot of sense to me. But what I'm noticing is that it feels like in this process of kind of hormonal shifts and changes, the way we communicate is very multidimensional, and it's informed by our feelings and emotions, and it expresses in, like, it's very multidimensional is the word that comes to mind versus linear. And so I think if you're trying to understand it and follow it from a linear perspective, you seem crazy.
And thank you for that call, Kelly. We're running short on time. Eleanor, in just last 15 seconds or so, talking and communicating is really key to all of this, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think the pressure gauge goes up and up and up. And I do think there is an element of truth in the fact that when women become menopausal, they sort of stop giving as much of it. And I don't know if I'm swearing on a bad time of day, but I think there is some truth in that. I think you let go of having given and given and given, and something falls away. But talking is so, so important.
And we'll leave it there. Eleanor Morgan is a journalist and the author of the new book, Hysterical, Why We Need to Talk About Women, Hormones, and Mental Health. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, as we age, there can be difficult questions about how to handle our finances. Our guest has advice for having productive conversations about money between aging parents and their adult children. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow after 7, more than 500,000 people in Wisconsin are struggling with hunger. For Thanksgiving Day, Kate Archer-Kent and her guest take a closer look at food insecurity in the state and the role that food pantries can play in ending hunger and homelessness. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then a reporter decided to randomly choose a date in recent history and research what happened around the nation. We'll talk with the author of the new book, One Day, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary 24 Hours in America. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.